welcome to Introducing Me. I'm your host, Sarah. I started this podcast to get to know other people and lifestyles while discovering more about myself. Each episode, I will give a new guest a chance to discuss their background, culture, interests, or whatever they want to talk about to help increase all of our own worldviews. Today, I would like to introduce you to Sarah Doble. That is Sarah without an H, unlike mine, which is with an H. You always gotta make that distinction with the Sarahs. But Sarah is here to talk a little bit about herself, but really she is here to talk about her job because she works at a zoo. And as we were talking before, I'm like, every little kid, you know, wants to work with animals, and she has made that dream come true. So I'm super excited to hear a little bit about that. So Sarah, why don't you go ahead and say hello?
Well, hello, everyone. And just to start you off with a ridiculous anecdote that ties into my job at the zoo and also our fabulous name combination of Sarah Sarah right now, I will tell you that when I started my job at the Buttonwood Park Zoo as their education program supervisor a couple of years ago, I was not told directly that our American bison's name is also Sarah with an H. But you can't really hear the H, so it doesn't really help the fact that I walked into a really uncomfortable conversation of two keepers talking about how Sarah had taken this really monstrous poop in the middle of the field. And I was like, I did no such thing. And it was a really nice icebreaker between me and some of the keepers when I got told later that week that Sarah was the name of the bison. So here we all are, Sarahs together being ridiculous. So there you go. That's to just get us started a little bit. But it is definitely a really cool place to work, and having the zoo experience that I have and the other teaching experience that I have and working experience that I have has been a really cool amalgamation of fun and education and, you know, intellectual pursuits, but also mostly ridiculous anecdotes, far too many of which include feces. So certainly I've got a lot of directions that we can go on this, and it just depends on which ridiculous stories you would like to hear. That's a little about me.
Well, I'm glad you started off that one, and I can't imagine what you were feeling those first couple days.
Yeah.
So why don't we start before you had this job at the zoo and when you were younger? When did you know that you wanted to work with animals, and then how did you get on the path to get where you are today?
You know, it's so funny because I feel like, as you said, so many kids, if you ask them what they want to be, and I work with a lot of children who come to our zoo camps and our zoo education programs, and they'll all tell you that they want to be a zookeeper, because when you're at a zoo, nothing seems more fantastic than getting to work with these amazing animals. And so I was a really early sucker for animals. And I think I probably tell the anecdote most about just being 5 years old. And I don't know if you've been to the Discovery Museum in Connecticut, but they have a little theater room off to the side that's just playing a constant loop of documentaries about whatever. And I was lucky enough to be there, again, as a very small child, when they were playing a documentary, probably a David Attenborough documentary, if I'm being honest, because aren't they always the best ones? And it was about bioluminescence in the deep ocean. And from that point on, I was completely hooked, and I wanted to go down in submarines, and I wanted to be the first person to film the giant squid. I actually ended up getting a scholarship in college in Southbury, Connecticut, for writing an essay about how I was going to be the person who went down in a submarine and found the giant squid. And I'm sure that they probably want their money back, because that did not happen. But it was very much my ambition at the time to be a marine biologist and to really explore the deep sea. And that's taken a lot of twists and turns. And of course, in elementary school, I think everybody is like, I'm going to be president and a lawyer, and I'm going to win an Oscar, and I'm going to be a star on Broadway, and I'm going to do a million different things. And then, of course, we end up all doing whatever ridiculously mundane things we do to pay taxes and et cetera. But I've been very fortunate. And so I ended up going to Bard College in Annandale and Hudson, New York, and studying biology. Totally accidental. I had looked up like what colleges had marine biology majors on the East Coast, and Bard came up, which is hilarious because it doesn't have that major at all. But I fell in love with the school and what it stands for and the experience of it. So I went and ended up working with primates. And so for my junior and senior year at Bard College, I was actually studying calotrichid monkeys, or like the little marmosets and tamarins, the cute, adorable monkeys that everybody wants that fit in your hand. And that's what I did all my research on in college, was cognition with them and, you know, operant conditioning and just a lot of cool stuff that got me this hands-on experience. It was at a very academically rigorous college that basically channeled everybody straight into a PhD program. And I had this major crisis of, academia where it's like, is it that I want to study monkeys or is that I want to play with monkeys? Like, is this, do I really care about the research I'm doing? Because writing a paper is terrible. But waking up really early to go in and have tiny monkeys jump on your shoulder, that part's fantastic. So I actually, and I'm a little ashamed to admit it, but I did a little self-sabotage of my applications to PhD programs. And I don't actually have the proof because I wrote these essays, submitted them, and then deleted them from my computer to make myself feel better. But I genuinely think that at some point the essays in my applications, which cost $50 to submit to each school, had things that basically were like, yeah, please don't accept me. I don't want to do this. I just need to send this envelope in to get some people off my back. I'm sure I wrote it in a more eloquent way, but it was such a crisis of faith of like, where am I going in life? And like, what do I actually want? So I kind of threw all that to the side and just Googled zoos by the ocean. And this one zoo came up and I just moved to Maine on a whim and became a zookeeper. And it was a really formative experience for me. It was not a great zoo. It was not AZA accredited, which is the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which is basically the gold standard in zoos for like highly, highly accredited and, you know, having really rigorous standards up to which you have to live. And this was not one of them. Now, I'd been spoiled because growing up in Connecticut, everything there is AZA accredited, which is impressive because there aren't a lot of them in the world, but they all in Connecticut, they're doing great. So I moved to this zoo, this non-AZA zoo, and it was great for a while, and I made a lot of friends and had a lot of cool experiences, worked with, you know, 50-plus exotic animal species, a lot of them monkeys. I got to do all the shows over the summer for, you know, big crowds, little crowds, weird crowds. It was great. And I suppose I did well enough at it that I was invited to stay on over the winter. And the second that the doors closed to the public, that third-party perspective was apparently what was keeping this zoo in check. And it was a really intense part of my life because just the conditions for the animals went down significantly. And there's this bizarre, almost Stockholm syndrome-like experience that a lot of the people I work with and I shared, where you couldn't leave because in your mind you were what was keeping these animals safe. Like if you left, the next person wasn't going to be able to do what you were doing to just barely scrape by. And so we all had this very weird sort of like brainwashed experience of like, oh my God, I can't leave and I can't report them because they're not AZA and what'll happen to the animals. And, you know, it was just a really crazy time for me that, you know, while I was in it, was really horrible. And certainly I do feel for the animals still, but it was what kind of pushed me to say like, I can't be a part of this. Like I need to not be enabling this behavior. And I couldn't do anything to stop it per se, because I knew that if I reported them, you know, the animals might be put down or they might be sold or they might be, you know, given out as pets or something. So I kind of just had to say, you know what? All right, this has been great. I'm going to go. And my big excuse to leave was to go and get my master's degree, you know, like you do on a whim without any life planning whatsoever. So I moved home and I got my master in arts in teaching. And I became a high school science teacher, which was crazy and wonderful. And I worked in a very affluent district, so it had unique challenges compared to, I also worked in an inner city district. So, you know, Danbury, Connecticut versus Wilton, Connecticut. A little, you know, slightly different on the socioeconomic scale, and therefore, sadly, the quality of public education that they receive. But it was fantastic. I mean, yeah, you cry and you laugh and you struggle and you love every second of it. But when it came time to move, I couldn't bring myself to get another teaching job. So I fell into that fun statistic of people who don't make it 5 years as an educator. And what I think it really was that being a zookeeper constantly was too much for me emotionally. Being a teacher was too much for me emotionally. And I needed to find a balance. And just kind of the entire world aligned everything perfectly for me so that I moved here with my now fiancé and found this amazing little AZA zoo that needed somebody to come and be half zookeeper, half teacher. And so that's where I'm at now. And it's just been a really wild ride with a lot of crazy turns and twists and learning experiences along the way.
And that's, I love the story of how you got out and were like, I'm going to go get another degree. And then it, like, fate kind of aligned with the job you're in now. So what, and we'll go to, like, pre-COVID times, and you can talk a little bit about what you're doing now. But pre-COVID, sure. When everything was full up and running, what were you doing? What is this teaching / zookeeping job like?
Oh, it's fantastic. So for me, I have a 5-day work week just like any other normal person, but 2 of those days would be just a full-on zookeeper. I work in a section called Animal Ambassadors, which is really special because our animals are raised and kept a little differently. They are trained and able to be handled. So I, of all the zookeepers, get to go in and really form these incredibly strong and powerful bonds with my animals. And so they'll come out to do encounters with the public or birthday parties or camps or education programs. We would drive around the state and bring them to meet other people and all sorts of things like that. So it definitely had a cool zookeeping component to it. But then at the same time, you know, we're doing those encounters, speaking with the public. And in those other 3 days, I was building curriculum and writing new programs, leading those programs, going again across the state or even a few states to teach them in different places. So there's that really neat teaching component as well. And lately it's gotten a little bit more interesting because even though I'm no longer full-time during all the fun that is COVID-19, I'm sure everyone's in that same boat, the different side of it has been that it gave me some extra time. My fiance was out to sea, so I was just kind of sitting around like, cool, how many crossword puzzles can I do today? Or should I maybe try something else? And I had this crazy notion last year for a corporate retreat event, like an escape room that took the entire zoo to complete. And it was kind of not shot down necessarily, but it wasn't the time, wasn't on the top of anyone's priority list. And so they kind of were like, oh, that's neat, maybe later. And so all of a sudden here we're desperate. You know, normally it's just, okay, how can we bring in the biggest number of people? What events can pack the most people into this zoo? How can we, like, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden it was like, okay, how can we have small amounts of people outside, distance from one another? Excellent. Because we had actually had to shut the zoo down for the very first time from March to the end of May, which was a crazy experience. So all of my programming was being done over Zoom or things like that, just the regular kind of accommodations people were trying to make. But I spent a lot of that extra time creating this massive zoo-wide escape experience, which is not anything that I have any right to, like, know how to do or anything. I just genuinely enjoy escape rooms. And as a high school teacher, I had done, like, an escape the box lab for my environmental science students, and they always kind of liked it. So I was like, you know what? Why not? I got nothing else going on. It's me and my cats. Like, I might as well just do this. And so I launched a program at the zoo called Deja Zoo. And, you know, it was our whole, like, the pitch was escape the Zoom. Like, come in here with a group of up to 10 friends. And you have an hour and a half to find out what makes Buttonwood Park Zoo unique. And I built this elaborate puzzle, and it literally takes them an hour and a half. They go through the entire zoo. They see all the animals. They solve puzzles. They have to do all these crazy challenges. And then at the end, of course, they have to solve, like, what makes us special and escape Deja Zoo. And that's been, like, the whole, you know, focal point of my focus to get me through COVID. So it's been totally a huge shift. I've still been going in as a zookeeper, but obviously, my classes and programs have been really different. So this has been a cool outlet for me creatively, but also scientifically, to be like, this is a thing. And the side effect is being that, you know, we're bringing in a little bit more money, which is nice. It helps to support our education and conservation missions. So it's been really fun for me just as a nerd who likes puzzles, but it's also been really gratifying as part of my job. And of course, you know, we work the animals into it, so they're a part of some of the puzzles. And you know, it's just like having a really big, weird, furry, and feathered family. So it's been nice when I can't see other people necessarily. You know, I've always had my animals there, and that's been really, really special. We've made so many changes, and they're all just to try and keep the animals safe. But, you know, people, they need positivity right now. And so going to the zoo has been such a cool thing to offer people, even if it looks different and even if the buildings are closed and you need a mask and everything. You know, I had to run summer camps through a computer all of a sudden. And when we started bringing them back on, there's nothing cuter and more ridiculous than a bunch of 5- and 6-year-olds with their little, you know, Anna and Elsa masks or their baby Yoda masks, just you know, so excited to be somewhere and see someone and get back into what life kind of used to be like. And honestly, some of them have even forgotten what it was like to not wear masks and to not be in small groups. And I went from being like the director of this big program where I got to hire counselors to it's just me surrounded by small children, like singing the hello song every morning. It's been a bizarre shift and I never thought I'd be here, but I love every second of it. It's ridiculous. So it's been a cool transition between not only just the other jobs I've done and this one, but what this job has sort of had to morph into. And I think I'm an obnoxiously strong enough personality that when these openings come up of like, well, we don't know what we're going to do. Anyone have any ideas? I'm like, what if I did this crazy, ridiculous thing because I want to and you're desperate. So it's been, there have been some silver linings for me during COVID that I've been crazy enough to take on because I can. But that's like a weird kind of overview of the strange mixture of zookeeper and educator and all that good stuff that I somehow get to get paid for.
Now, do you think that Deja Zoo will continue when, you know, masks are no longer a thing, small groups are not needed, and the zoo can be as crowded as it would normally be?
I really hope so. I mean, I started trying to pitch this idea back before COVID had ever happened as a corporate retreat that would take a whole day and be similar to what it is now, but certainly with a more sophisticated component because it would be geared entirely at adults. But I've definitely already started thinking of other ways that we can do it and how convenient it'll be once we can have the buildings more open. Or if we don't have all these restrictions, it can be during the day. It's been really tough because, you know, we're doing it now all of a sudden facing the light. We have to do it after the zoo closes, but before it's pitch black, which is a smaller and smaller time frame. But I'm hoping that there are a lot of things that COVID has brought about into the zoo world that are going to stick and that are going to get made permanent, not out of necessity, but just out of enjoyment. You know, there have been some changes that I found really positive that I think if we can stick to it, could be really good. And I think that these small, intimate group programs that can run anytime is great. Because I think if there's one thing that I've learned from this whole experience, it's been to just appreciate who we have and what we have and what we're able to do. Because, you know, there were a lot of people who went home on Friday in March and then just didn't get to go back, either for a long time or for permanently. And so for me, it's definitely been an endeavor in trying to appreciate things as they're there and just say, you know what, we're going to do this to its fullest and it might be weird, but we're going to tough it out because it might just be like this or it might not. But you got to just kind of enjoy the things that are there while they're there. And I think that we can, you know, hopefully grow from this in that respect as well.
I would hope so as well. There's definitely a lot that we can grow from, adjustments being made. And as you said earlier, like even the kids not remembering the before. So it'll be another new normal for some people.
That phrase has been such like a pebble in my shoe. And I love it because it's so useful right now. But also the idea of like the new normal, just, aren't we all just so terrified of what that means in every different situation? We're such creatures of habit and comfort that it's been such an exercise in flexibility and, you know, being able to just turn on a dime and be like, oh, okay. My fiance and I, for Halloween, built a candy slide from our door. We knocked the screen out of our door and hooked up like we had covered it in tinfoil, but it was this cardboard slide that went all the way down our front steps, and we made a huge sign that was like, I forget, I had some really corny rhyme because it's me and that's all I do in my spare time. But it was like trick or treat and pick a sweet or something like that. And we had pictures of all the candy we had and we had tongs to take the candy and slide it down the chute into their bags. And I was so jazzed about it. And we had like 6 kids come, which is obviously the better idea, but I was still so ready. So, I mean, I guess that's just the microcosm of my personality is being like, all right, we're going to make the most out of this and it's going to be great and we're just going to go with it. So who knows, but it's certainly been interesting with the animals. It's been tough. We found out the Bronx Zoo's tiger, I believe, was one of the first animals that came out as having COVID, and it came out really early on. So the zoo had to make so many crazy changes to keep the animals safe. And people have been really good for the most part. But what I found most interesting, and I think anyone works in a restaurant would probably be the least shocked by this information, is that people have had a lot more trouble caring about other people than about animals. And again, to jump back to, you know, kids, they want to be zookeepers. There's something about animals that just can weasel its way into any Scrooge's heart, I think. And so when I've walked around and people have their masks down or be not socially distancing, I've completely given up on being like, please put your mask back on to keep myself and the other zookeepers safe or the other zoo guests safe. But I've had so much more luck going up and being like, well, we don't know how COVID could affect some of our animals. So for the sake of the animals, I'm going to have to ask you to put the mask up. And oh my gosh, it's like you told them, like, if you don't put your mask on, I'm going to shoot this monkey in front of you, which I hate to say, but also like, hey, if it works, I'm not going to, you know, mince words trying to get somebody to protect my animals because I care a lot more about my animals than about basically anything else in the universe. So it's been an interesting challenge, but it is kind of heartwarming in a really twisted way to see how much, like, people's love of animals is apparently much higher up than people's love of their fellow human. I guess I'm not shocked, but it's kind of funny to see it in action. So
yeah, you just have to learn the right thing to say to people to get them to respond well.
Yeah, we've had not so much practice, which is good. People have surprised me and been pretty successful, but certainly there are a few who are like, ah, but my nose needs its freedom. And that's when you got to dangle that little like, oh, you could be the death of these animals. And they're like, oh, God, all right, I'll cover my nose. So if it works, it works. You do what you got to do.
Right. Now, you mentioned that you have some cats at home. Is it correct that there's more than one?
There are two cats. Bonnie and Dune are my lovely little kittens, which has been its own strange struggle because I don't know if you would have thought of this, but working with zoo animals, your shoes get really dirty, as do a number of other things. I actually, when I first got engaged, I was wearing my ring to work, which was dumb, but I was like, this is shiny and I'm obsessed with it and I'm going to have it on me all the time. And so you don't even want to know, as a zookeeper, I mean, not just like dirt and mud and stuff, but we're talking like I have to butcher rats and guinea pigs and rabbits and things like that on a daily basis because a lot of my animals are carnivores. And there's no other option. If you're feeding bobcats and you're feeding birds of prey, like that's just a part of your day now. And then so you've got blood on your hands, you've got raw meat on your hands. Every single day starts by cleaning everyone's enclosure and everybody's habitat needs to be tidied. So, of course, you're coming into contact with feces and with urine, which hopefully don't touch your hands. But listen, you know, life is hard. So I have this really strange memory of going to get my ring appraised for insurance. And I was like, hey, but, you know, by the way, could you maybe clean it? Because it's probably a little dirty. And this poor guy had it running in his like ridiculously powerful jewelry cleaning machine for like 10 minutes. And his dad, who owned the store, came out and was like, took it out. He's like, this has been running way too long. He's like, this is filthy. Like, what did you loaded it wrong? And the guy was so embarrassed. He like went over to his dad and he's like, no, it was just like the dirtiest ring I've ever seen in my life. And the guy kind of looked at me almost like impressed. And he was like, what is, you just like use a lot of lotion or do you like garden or something? I was like, yep, that's what it is. It's nothing else. There's nothing disgusting on it. There's no poop. There's no blood. There's no dirt. Nope, that would never happen. What's wrong with you? So that was kind of hilarious. But anyway, it's been really tricky because not only having my pets with the zoo animals, I have to basically like clean out almost like a nurse or something like that. So you have to change your shoes and throw your clothes right in the laundry just to make sure you're not bringing any kind of foreign pathogens in that could infect your animals. But with COVID too, it's been really crazy because we know that mammals are the most likely to be susceptible. And I don't see that many people in my little personal bubble. But for instance, our Halloween event, Boo at the Zoo, did incredibly well because people are desperate for interaction and experiences. So we did all the things right that we could for guests. You know, they had their masks on, they were socially distanced. We had the candy stations, like the one that I set up at my house, definitely stole that idea from the zoo. We had timed entry, so we did a great job for those people. But at the end of the day, even if our guests only saw 40 people in their experience at the zoo, I was there all day. So So, you know, my brother and sister-in-law who live in Montreal right now got locked down to the extreme by their government, who was saying no guests, no leaving the country, no nothing. And on my first day working at Boo at the Zoo, I saw around 1,400 people, which is a little interesting to compare. But then on top of it, you come home and you worry, you know, I've got these animals that rely completely on me. I've got people in my circle who, you know, I'm putting kind of at this risk. So it's a really strange circumstance. But yeah, I've got my lovely little cats who I've been obsessively trying to protect from the world these days, my little indoor kitty cats. I also have a leopard gecko that I acquired from a high school student because we love high school students who get pets and then go to college and their parents are like, no, that's not coming with me, no. So I adopted a leopard gecko that had been like just left at the high school. And he's awesome. And I also have a parakeet because you got to just keep your life interesting, right?
Right.
And just surrounding myself with all the animals. It's so ridiculous. But I got to say, there's nothing in life that makes me happier than animals. We even have a personal vendetta with a squirrel that lives in the tree next to our window. And it's like a daily battle of Dennis the Menace proportions between my fiance and the stupid squirrel that just hate each other. But I love it. I think it's the funniest thing in the world. I would fill my entire life with animals. I'm trying. I'm doing my absolute best. But I still, like, anytime I travel somewhere, the first thing I'm like, oh, do they have a zoo? Can we go? As if that's what a normal person does. Is like, oh, I left my office and I have a long weekend. Are there offices here? Can I go see the offices? I love offices. This is fantastic. But it's that magic, that animal magic that keeps coming back up. And I don't think anybody loses that. I think you could take the grumpiest person in the world and, like, show them a cute puppy. And they're like, okay, that's nice. I like that. But that could just be me. Who knows?
Now, are you planning to get more animals at home? Or are you, like, good with what you have?
No, I'm just going to keep adding to the collection. It's this very strange, like, adult-y type scenario where I've had to basically create the calculus of my life clock here. So, you know, assuming that my wedding still happens as planned at the time frame that I had hoped before COVID, then we're looking to maybe get some dogs. And we can just make life even more crazy and hairy and disgusting, but adorable, right? It's good they're cute because they can be disgusting, but it's worth it. We still love them. So yeah, hopefully we'll add more to the menagerie, but who knows? Humans will be included in that, so at some point I suppose they'll have to take precedence. I hear they're expensive and demanding for at least the first 18 years, so, you know, we'll see who fits where in the puzzle of life.
Yeah. So does your fiance also love animals just as much as you, that he's good with all of these animals in the house?
Absolutely. And it's the strangest coincidence, but his sister actually was a zookeeper at the Beardsley Zoo. And so I think there's something to be said for just like animal people kind of attract one another, because I know more zookeepers than most people, being one, that I get to at least count my coworkers. But outside of my immediate circle of coworkers at the zoos and the aquarium that I worked at, I can't say as I've met anyone random who was like, oh yeah, I'm a zookeeper. That's what I do. Like, I know the zookeepers I know because I'm a zookeeper. So it's really funny that if I stop and think about, like, well, who's the only other zookeeper that I've ever met outside of my immediate, like, working or learning sphere, and it happens to be my fiance's sister, which I think is just a fabulous, like, sign from the fates. So, like, oh, this works out. These are similar people. Let's make this happen. But he loves animals, and he's grown up in a family that certainly has enjoyed animals as well. So his dearest ambition is to just secretly steal about half the animals from my zoo, which I've assured him won't happen, but it's very tempting. We have baby red panda right now, Kodo. She's the cutest thing you've ever seen in your life. We have the smallest species of deer in the world called Chilean pudu. Those are ridiculous. He really likes our beavers. We have some really cute beavers. So he just slowly hatches kind of Pinky in the Brain-esque schemes to steal a number of our zoo animals. And thank goodness none of them have worked. To be fair, none of them have actually been enacted, but there have been sketches involved. There's been a lot of talk. So I just have to keep, you know, checking his backpack anytime he goes through New Bedford and be like, did you steal a zoo animal today? No? Okay, good. But I think he's a little jealous because he's got like an actual real adult person job. So for me to get to run around with, you know, zoo animals and sing song with toddlers and make toilet paper tube, you know, craft skunks is definitely, you know, I think he's a little jealous. He loves the animals. Although I did come home with some really interesting cuts on my hands yesterday, which I have to tell you is the cutest injury I've ever sustained because I had to trim our two striped skunks' nails. And if you've ever trimmed a skunk's nails, which I'm sure you have.
Of course.
Because haven't we all? They have very, very long nails, very similar to like cat claws. And, you know, you can sort of see through them, but basically you have to get them to sit still. So you have to kind of scoop them up and put them in your lap in that little like baby seated position. And, you know, you can spread their little nails apart and trim their claws. So my little skunks are sitting there like little human babies in my lap with their little hands over my hand. And, of course, because I was in the process of cutting their nails, which were pretty long, I have the cutest little red marks on my hand from them just kind of like, oh, okay. But that, I mean, it's like, what better injury could you possibly have than one that involves you getting to tell a story about how you cuddled a skunk? I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen a skunk up close, but they're ridiculously adorable. I love, we've got a bunch of animals that are in our Animal Ambassador collection. Most of them have been like orphaned or injured or something like that. So they're no longer able to live in the wild. And so they come to us. And all of our animals by default have to have the right temperament to be an Animal Ambassador, which means that I have the nicest, sweetest, smartest, most wonderful animals in the world. Definitely not biased. That is a scientific fact. Look it up. My animals are the best animals. But it's been really fun for me, especially because so many of our animals people fall in love with immediately. We have screech owls, red-tailed hawks, you know, just really cute fennec foxes, things that no person with a heart could look at and not love. But what I really enjoy is we have an opossum, and we have our two skunks. And the skunks are super cute regardless, but people are really nervous about their spray. So it's been really fun to sort of educate people about these animals that they have this innate kind of like, oh my God, run away, which is totally the right reaction, by the way. If you see one in the wild, leave. But they're really just sweet, gentle creatures. And it's been so cool to introduce people to that side of them. And then my favorite is probably our opossum because people have this horrible impression of opossums, which in my mind are one of the most incredible animals in the universe because a single Virginia opossum has a lifespan of only 2 years. But in those 2 years, they'll eat up to 5,000 ticks a season because that's like one of the number one things that they eat. Because they're so fastidious at cleaning themselves, they almost never get Lyme disease. Their blood temperature is so low that it's almost impossible for them to get rabies. They're immune to a lot of snake bite venoms. I mean, they're just these fantastically amazing creatures. There are only marsupial in North America. They keep their babies in a pouch, just like their very similarly named but not closely related friends, the possums over in Australia. And they have the most teeth of any North American mammal. So each one has 50 teeth. I mean, like they're just the coolest little creatures. And the ones that I get to take care of look like little stuffed animals. Whereas for some reason, if you look on the internet and you look up Virginia opossum, you'll only see them making the craziest, most terrifying faces. Which is probably because somebody just stuck a camera in their face and they think they're about to die. So they put on the biggest show in the world. But I love it. I love taking something that people have this, like, I hate this and they're terrible and I'm afraid of them. And getting to show them, like, okay, first of all, everything that you think you know about them is wrong. But also, let me tell you, above and beyond that, not only are those things not true, here's a bunch of true stuff that makes them one of the most important parts of our ecosystem. So for me, like I learned a lot of this stuff after starting this job. So it's been a huge learning process for me. And I just get to fall in love with these different animals and to share that with people, which is so cool for me. I mean, it basically would be like pick your favorite fandom, like your favorite thing that you're a nerd over. And imagine that your job was just to go talk to the public about how awesome that thing is. It would be like if I got paid 5 days a week to just go find people and be like, but listen, let me tell you my favorite part about Harry Potter. Let me tell you why these characters are so neat and nuanced. I mean, sure, some people would be interested in listening to that, but it's like a pipe dream. Nobody's going to pay you to do that. And yet here I am with all these amazing animals that I get to work with And I get to tell people about how cool they are. And because they're my animals, you know, they have names and they have stories. So I get to really, like, get people into these animals. And everyone's excited about animals. So you couldn't have a more captive or willing audience. So it really is just a miracle that I somehow get to do this and people give me money for it. But I guess some people just have all the luck. And I guess I'm just one of those people because that is what I do as a job.
And it sounds like so much fun, and it sounds like you're doing a lot of good things, and I'm sure that, like, everyone who comes loves all the different activities. So you mentioned that originally you had wanted to, you know, deep sea exploration. So would you ever go to working for an aquarium more full-time and work with aquatic animals, or are you, since, you know, spending the time with the monkeys, forever going to be a zookeeper?
Oh, the monkeys. I miss the monkeys because my animal ambassador section really is not ideal for primates. They really shouldn't be handled to that degree. So we have tons of monkeys that I get to go and see and fall in love with every day. We have new little baby monkeys that were just born that melt my heart that I go visit. But I don't really get to work with them like I did at the other zoo. However, now that you bring it up, I did actually start my career in college at the Maritime Aquarium in Connecticut. So I have worked at an aquarium. Granted, it was as an educator, which was a weird theme. I had never intended to be a teacher, and it just followed me everywhere I went. And I finally just threw in the towel and was like, apparently, this is what I should be doing. And what a wonderful choice that was to finally listen to all of my subconscious decisions, because I love teaching, and I think it's a lot of fun. But I did work at an aquarium, and it was great. I do love aquatic animals still. I will say that the monkeys, yeah, have just ruined me. For working at an aquarium. I can't. I have to be near monkeys. And living in Massachusetts, you really only have one option, which is going to a zoo. I will say, though, when I moved to Massachusetts, it was not with any particular job in mind. And it certainly wasn't with this zoo in mind. So when we moved here, it was just because we were ready to buy a house. And it's an area that my fiance loves because it's near his college. And it's an absolutely wonderful area anyway. So I'm really excited about that. And when we got here, I had a lot of options, and I was kind of desperate because I needed to find a job. I had just left my teaching position, and I wasn't ready to jump back into it. I kept my certification up as a backup because I did love it. But I started looking back into kind of animal husbandry and things like that, and even the education side, which is where I, again, always kind of find myself slipping in because it is something that comes very naturally to me and that I really genuinely enjoy doing. But I looked at some animal rehabilitation centers, both as a rehabber, but also as an educator. I was offered some jobs that I didn't end up taking, as you might have guessed. And certainly looking into, like, Mass Audubon, which is a fabulous program that has sites all over Massachusetts and has had, up until this past year, a really excellent education program as well. Unfortunately, they've taken a huge hit because nonprofits don't necessarily do particularly well when money stops happening. But definitely Mass Audubon was a place that I'd always thought, oh, that would be so cool to work there. I even am close enough to Woods Hole that I was sort of sneaking a peek there to see, oh, maybe that submarine thing could still happen. But alas, PhDs are apparently important to scientists. Who knew? I would love one day maybe to get a PhD, but I'm embarrassed to say it would probably just be to sound fancy. I really don't love writing long papers, so it may not happen. But I definitely was sort of tempted back, living as close to the ocean as I do, into that ocean world, because I find it so fascinating and so mysterious. I mean, it's like watching space documentaries to me. Like, watching an undersea documentary is just a whole other world that we know so little about. So I'm always fascinated by it, and you know, every time a new documentary comes out, I have to watch it. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. I wish I could do this. But at the end of the day, you basically nailed it. Like, monkeys have just ruined me. I have to play with the monkeys. And I suppose I have to play with the apes too, because all the kids that I work with are so funny and ridiculous and rewarding to work with that I don't find myself terribly tempted now that this job came up. And I will say that if there's anybody listening to this that is having trouble finding a dream job, I have to pass on the best advice I've ever gotten in my entire life, just from my sister-in-law, because I applied for a job at this zoo before the one that I got, and I did not get it. I did not even get an interview for it. I got an email that said, we're sorry, but the position is full and like, keep your eye open. And I kind of just hung up the towel and was like, all right, well, you know, that's that. I gave it my best. You know, I was applying for a lot of other jobs and I was, you know, in the higher rankings for some of them. So maybe that was going to happen, maybe not. And my sister-in-law was like, you know, if this is something you really love, like just send them an email and ask to go in and talk to the person who would have been your boss and just see what it's about. She's like, the worst that they can say is no. And I was like, well, I suppose that's true. So I kind of plucked up my courage and wrote an email to the woman who is now my boss and just said, you know what? I understand you don't have any jobs open, but I love what you guys do. And I'd be really interested to hear more about it and to talk to you about the path that you took to get where you are, just as a sort of informative experience for me and if it wouldn't be too much bother for you. And she got right back to me and she said, that would be wonderful. Let's schedule a time you can come in and we'll just talk for an hour. And it ended up basically being an interview for a job that didn't exist. But it was wonderful and I got to hear her story and I had my resume there for her and just, well, what can I be doing in the spare time that until another job comes up here, I can make myself look more tempting so that when that job does come up, you will want me as your person. And she kind of looked at my resume and she was like, oh, nothing in particular, you know, just didn't happen this time, but everything looks great and, you know, good luck and take a walk around the zoo, see it. We have a class going on. You want to go see it and meet the educators. And it ended up being just a few weeks later even that she sent me an email and she was like, hey, we actually have a job open, which was originally going to be listed as the same job I had already applied, for which I had already applied. But instead, she had taken that application or that job listing, given it a new title, Education Program Supervisor, which is my current title. And I swear to you, the requirements for the job were, I think, taken almost directly from my resume, perhaps just in an effort to get as few people to apply as possible, because you know I had my application in like 2 hours later. And, you know, as luck would have it, that was it. So that job, basically, in my head, and I could be wildly delirious here, I suppose, but in my head, this job ended up basically being created for me because I took this random leap on my sister-in-law's recommendation that paid off in ways I could never have imagined. And it really is just, if ever there were a job that somebody could make for me, man, it would be this one. So it was really cool. And I try to tell people that all the time now of like, you know what? What's the worst that's going to happen? Like, best case scenario, you go and meet this person for an hour and then they create a job specifically for you and give it to you a few weeks later. Worst case scenario, they can say no. Definitely worth it. So I like telling that anecdote just in case it inspires somebody to take a similar jump and hopefully have it pay off in a similar way, because apparently it works sometimes, as I am living, breathing proof. So who knew?
Yeah, and it is good advice, and especially in like the world of nonprofits and where volunteerism is an option, like getting your foot in the door some way. And for you, that was literally meeting with the supervisor will go a long way.
Sure. It's really crazy because as much as everybody I find wants to work at zoos at some point in their life and wants to work with animals, whether it's a realistic dream or just like, wouldn't that be so cool to work with these animals? Working at a zoo is an incredibly, incredibly competitive field. And it's unfortunately, as I think has been drawn into much harsher light this year with all of the Black Lives Matter movements and things like that, it's a really Caucasian-dominated field. And it's really unfortunate because I can't say that I know a single zookeeper who doesn't have a crazy amount of unpaid internship experience, myself included. And it's really unfortunate because if you look around my zoo, the vast majority of the employees are from upper middle class white families, because these are people who can afford a really low income job and they can afford to have a resume filled with unpaid internship experience during high school and college and even after college. So it comes with so much privilege. And so not only do I start off telling people who say they might want to work at a zoo, like, okay, well, you know, when you're in high school and college, you better be using that time to get your foot in as many doors as possible with all these internship experiences. And also, you know, how crazy is it to look at a 21-year-old and be like, well, how many years have you worked with primates? I mean, that's an insane thing to say to somebody. But the reality is that by the time I had graduated college, I had worked at an aquarium for 2 summers, one unpaid and one paid. And I had done 1.5 years of primate cognitive research at a zoo that was near my school. And so I was able to leave college and say, oh, here are the things I've already done, which is bananas. Because if you have to support yourself in any way, shape, or form, you didn't do that. You had a job or you had 2 jobs, you know? And so it's a really unfortunately difficult field to break into because not only are there not as many jobs as there are people who want to do it, but if you refuse to do it for free, somebody else will. Or if you refuse to do it for minimum wage, somebody else will. And even beyond just the competitiveness of like who got the better internships, who got the better jobs over the summer and things like that, there's also, again, that whole like, well, can you afford to be a zookeeper? Which for some people, the answer is no. So it's really, really tricky. And then for me, it's really funny because what a lot of people will do to get in to a zoo will be to start in the education department, which is just tragedy to me because I love the education department. It's where I would choose to be. I love that I get to be a zookeeper for half of my time, but I certainly love that I get to be an educator for the rest of it. So for me to see a lot of people saying, well, nobody wants the education job. So if you can get the education job to get the experience, then when a zookeeping job opens up, they can hire you internally out of the education department. And that's a super common shortcut that people trying to get zoo jobs will take. Again, much to my sadness and grief and disappointment, because I want all the educators to be people with this burning, insane passion for teaching people about animals because that's who I am and that's what I think it deserves. But it is a really crazy field in terms of just like getting in is very difficult. We have a zookeeper who was just hired after years of like full work for no money. But she was next on the list because she had put in the most time. So basically the message that we're sending is like, you have to be able to do this for free until we can afford or find a time in our busy schedules to pay you. And that's no fault of my own zoo. It's just the sad state that we're in as a nonprofit. I mean, the zoo itself is run by the city, but the Buttonwood Park Zoological Society is a nonprofit and a phenomenal nonprofit that does incredible work, not just in our community, but also around the world for conservation and education, particularly with Asian elephants, but also with a number of other species. But it's just, you know, that's where the money is going. We're trying to, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, you're trying to save the world at some point. And so, yeah, if you can get people to come in who are willing and happy to come in and clean up after your animals for a couple days a week, you know, I have these incredible interns right now, and they all want to be zookeepers. And right now, they're working other jobs, or they're finishing their education, and they're coming in and working with me for free. They're being paid in something they can write on their resume and a skill set that they now know how to do. I'm sure they would all say it's worth it, but it is definitely an interesting conversation to have on a larger scale where it's like, you know, there's definitely an issue with the fact that we have this really elite and kind of private and insanely competitive culture. Not necessarily because anybody wants it that way. I mean, certainly we go through a lot of effort to make sure that we can diversify our intern pool, and we have a conservation keepers program that's a paid version to try and bring in some people who deserve to have this experience but can't afford to have this experience. But I think that this year especially has brought into a really harsh light just how much work there is still left to do in the zoo field to try and even the playing field, because this is not just something that upper middle class people should get to do or that just white people should get to do. I mean, these animals are incredible, and there's this massive untapped resource of potential in communities that just can't afford to give away their time. So it's really been interesting. And I know I've gotten really off of the original question, but I just think it's so important to look at, especially in a field that I adore, but to say like, listen, we can be doing better. We can be including way more people and tapping into a lot more resources of, you know, this potential out there So it's something that I always try to find a way to bring up because I just think it's so important to see.
And it is important. And I'm glad that you shared that and that you also are aware of what's happening, and to also hear that your zoo is trying to do things about it and give opportunities to people who might not have gotten them because they can't afford them. Now, before we wrap up, because we've been talking about animals this whole time, I do want to ask like a quick personal question.
Sure.
And that is simply just how you and your fiance met, because you mentioned that you moved with him because you bought a house, but we haven't heard his name and we don't know, you know, how you two got to where you are.
Well, that is a very funny story, actually. And I like to think that it's a romantic story, but it starts off the way that I think so many millennial love stories do, which is online. So we actually met on eHarmony, which was incredibly fortuitous because I had been on and off of dating sites for about 5 years, probably at the time. And I had had a handful of boyfriends who increased dramatically in quality over the course of the three of them, I would say. So it's all building up, very important learning experiences along the way, but luckily, you know, got me to where I am now. And much to my annoyance now, although it's adorable, Kurt, my fiance, Curtis, he signed up and I was in literally his first batch of matches on eHarmony. Like genuinely, literally, first one. So I basically was just waiting for him to show up. And it was really lucky as well because he had had his preferences set to anywhere in the world. And I, myself, being the crazy homebody, said, like, maybe in 50 miles, maybe that would be okay. And just luckily, he happened to also be from Connecticut. So we were matched up in that way. And he was out to sea. He was off the coast of California at the time. He's a marine engineer. So he was on a ship. And, you know, he was, what, 3,000 miles away, and I just was, like, not having it. So we met, and we got to talking, and I was like, that's great. This guy's so fun to talk to. I hope I'm not leading him on, but at the end of the day, like, I'm not going to date the guy on the boat. And my mom makes jokes about it all the time because here I am about to marry the guy on the boat, which was the only name she had for him for a very long time. And it actually ended up being that I was, you know, meeting other people on eHarmony and comparing them to him. I was like, well, this guy's not as fun to talk to as the guy on the boat, so why would I date this guy? So he was this random bar of like, well, I'm not going to date him. So, and you know, I want to say 3 months or so went by like this, where we were just emailing back and forth, these tremendously long emails every day at this crazy, you know, inconvenient schedule because he was out to sea, so he only had the internet like an hour each day. So we'd just be waiting for one another to respond. And it finally got to the point where a couple of really nice guys all of a sudden had started talking to me. And I was like, oh, hey, there you go. All right. And they all kind of simultaneously were like, oh, do you want to get coffee? And I took a pause and was like, you know what? I can't. I'm dating someone. And they were all kind of like, well, why didn't you mention this before? And I was just like, I didn't know until right now. So poor Kurt, I gave him a call, and he was on this crazy road trip back, and the Jeep he had just bought in California, driving it cross country, stopping at all sorts of national parks and one Weird Al concert, and on his way back, so I just called him, and I was like, hey, I don't want to freak you out, but I just canceled a couple dates and also my eHarmony subscription, which, to be fair, was about to expire, like, in a couple weeks. So it wasn't some big dramatic gesture. I just kind of was like, hey, just so you know. And he, rightly so, was like, okay, cool, I'll call you back, and hung up, and I'm like, ah, great, I freaked this guy out. And he calls me back, like, 20 minutes later, and he's like, hey, so I deleted mine, too, which was dumb, because he's a guy, so he had paid for a 12-month subscription for oodles of money, and had just canceled it with no refund or anything to come see me, a person he had never met, ever. And luckily for him, as you might have guessed, it did end up working out. But it was very cute. We had a whole, like, weekend date planned to drive up to, you guessed it, the exact town that we live in currently, for, like, a nice romantic first date weekend, which is funny. We actually ended up staying at an inn that's now about a 5-minute walk from our house, which is pretty cute. But we couldn't even wait that long because he got back on a Monday and we weren't going to leave until Friday night. And so we ended up meeting at a Panda Express, which is his favorite. I've never had it before. So we used to joke about it all the time. We're like, oh, we're going to go to Panda Express. So we met at a mall, Panda Express. And that was it. And we've just been together ever since. And it was especially cute because we got engaged a few years ago and ended up going to a Panda Express to celebrate. That's just sort of a silly thing. And I this is going to sound so fake, and I promise you that this is true. But I, like, got my fortune cookie, you know, with our food. And I was like, this is going to say something perfect. I just know it. I have never had a fortune cookie say anything that wasn't stupid in my whole life. I mean, it's only fun for me when you do, like, the ad in bed after it and it's funny. You know, it's they're always stupid. And I'm not even kidding you. I opened this fortune cookie on the day we got engaged, almost 2 years ahead of the date that we're supposed to get married. It's all just very lovely. And it said, "Today is your lucky day," which I just thought was the coolest thing ever. And I still have, I keep it in my wallet with me because you have to. You have to keep something like that. And I just thought it was like the dumbest, most perfect thing ever. So now there's this ridiculously tacky food chain that to me, like, is just, you know, the shining light of, I see it and I'm like, oh, we gotta go get Panda. But I just think it's really funny. So that's our crazy story about how we met. But you know what? It ends up being very sweet because I think at this day and age, people are going to basically have to meet online because where do you even meet people, especially in COVID? I know so many people dating during COVID, and I'm like, that sucks. I'm sorry. How terrible. But, you know, for us to have met, and not just have met and started dating, to have met and to have been long-distance pen pals for 4 months before we ever met, I mean, it was basically just like every day was a struggle as we got off the phone to remember not to say I love you to this person we'd never met in person ever. And, you know, when he's shipped out since then, you know, he had come home for about 2 months and we started dating for those 2 months. And then he had to ship out again for another 3 months. And this time he had to go, you know, across the world. So 8,000 miles away in the middle of the ocean to an island I've never been to. It was just a crazy journey of struggles and of long distance. I don't think anyone does long distance on purpose. And I've had so many people be like, I don't know how you do it. And I'm just like, I do it because the other option is to not be with this person, which as of now seems about as crazy as being like, well, I mean, couldn't you just go the rest of your life without oxygen? That seems doable. It's kind of the same thing at this point where it's just like, there's not anything that I basically wouldn't give up. And even if it means time apart from one another, which I think him getting stuck out to sea for 6 months during COVID was probably the breaking point. Maybe we're going to try and find some shoreside work these days. But I mean, if we can get through 6 months when the entire world has shut down, being apart from one another, then I think it's going to take a hell of a lot to try and keep us apart now. So who knows? We'll see. But that's our little goofy love story that involves way too much Chinese takeout. But I like it.
I like it too. It was great to hear that story and hear a little bit into your life. Now, with all of my guests, before I wrap up, I ask them a random question that doesn't have to do with anything we've talked about.
Excellent.
So my question,
I love it.
My question for you is, it does not have to be specifically like Christmas related.
Okay.
But what is...
Nobody else can see my crazy Christmas sweater, but you can. So you should know that it will probably be Christmas related.
What is your favorite holiday tradition?
Oh, man. I love it. This is going to be impossible because I have a ton. I'll tell you, the first thing that came to mind is really stupid, which makes me think you'll probably enjoy it the most. So I'm going to tell you about, believe it or not, a non-Christmas tradition. Simply because I think it's hilarious that my brother and I made up not a holiday, but certainly a lot to do with one. So when we were kids back in good old Southbury, Connecticut, as you well know, very exciting place to be a child. Any year, you know, you got St. Patrick's Day, that one kind of just jumps around. There's nothing super special about it. You just, like, if you don't wear the right color, people hurt you. So that's not like my favorite tradition in the whole world. So instead, my brother and I made up a new one and just sprung it on our parents as if they should have known about this for years and been doing it. So I don't recall quite how young we were, but I think I was probably still like a toddler, albeit a very precocious one. And my brother is 2 years older. And we very like matter-of-factly told my mother about how leprechauns hide those chocolate gold coins in all the plants in the house. Obviously, everyone knows that. And props to her, that woman went out and made it happen. And so I didn't realize that this wasn't something everyone did until probably high school or college, when I like said it to someone and they were like, that's insane. No one does that. And I was like, well, two people do. So yeah, the tradition for us was somehow my parents would sneak those like bags of the gold coins, one each under our pillows. And then in all of the real live green plants in the house, they would hide a little coin or two, a little chocolate coin. Not in the fake ones. Leprechauns don't buy that crap. Only the real ones. And I'm obsessed with it. I think it is the most ridiculous thing. Not only that two small children would like just create an entire thing and be like, yeah, this actually happened. So yeah. But also that we had the wherewithal to like just tell my mom, and that she would then be like, yeah, sure, I've heard that, and go out. I don't even know where you buy the amount of chocolate gold coins that took. And proceeded to do it, I want to say, until we had both moved out of our home. Like, I think that kept up until I left for college at 17. And my brother, just, you know, to throw this at you really quickly, is a professional ballet dancer, as one would expect. And so he had moved out much earlier because he was in Manhattan. And he started at American Ballet Theater at 16. So he was certainly not at home as much. But yeah, basically by 15 or 16, we're still wandering around our house on whatever random day St. Patrick's Day is, finding gold coins as hurriedly as possible before we have to go to school. So there's a ridiculous holiday tradition. If you could see what my house looks like right now, you would know that there are certainly an abundance of insane Christmas traditions as well. And in fact, for what it's worth, in my household, I'd like to say that every holiday comes with its own insane traditions. So I could go on and on and on. But for some reason, the one that my brother and I just created out of nowhere, and then my mother, wonderful woman that she is, and my father, I should give him credit too. He had to go to school as well. He's a teacher, so he had none of that time, I assume. He was more the Easter bunny, keeping very, very busy on Easter. But yeah, the two of them, my mom and dad, just like somehow, without missing a beat, were like, yeah, absolutely. Of course there are going to be chocolate gold coins in every real plant of the house every random St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, So there you go. If you want to do that with your family one day, that's the totally true, not made up at all St. Patrick's Day tradition. It's written in the textbooks of yore. It's been going on forever and ever and ever since St. Patrick was around. And I assume that he is a saint because he hid chocolate coins in all of the Irish folks' plants, right? That's how that started? Something like that. Anyway, I've derailed a little, but hopefully you found that anecdote amusing.
That's great. And I hope that when you have the kids and the dogs and the everything, that you have real plants that you can hide chocolate coins.
We're going to have to keep the real plants up higher than the dogs, I think. So it's going to be a balancing act. But my parents pulled it off. So if they can do it, hopefully they pass down some of their St. Patrick's Day magic to me as well.
Okay, so that brings this episode to a close. I will be leaving a link to the Buttonwood Park Zoo in the description. So if you would like to look and see all the great animals that Sarah has been talking about and the cool programs that she has gotten up to, that information will be in the description. And if you would like to connect with the podcast on social media, all of that information is there as well. And if you would like to guest on the podcast or just shoot me an email and say, hey, I'm listening, or hey, I have these questions, I always love connecting with my listeners. So the email is introducingmepodcast@gmail.com. And thank you so much, Sarah, for spending time with me today. I appreciated hearing all of your fun animal stories. And to my listeners, for taking the time out of your day to hear a new story. Until next time, bye.
Thanks so much for having me. Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening.